Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
The primary way in which democracies have died since the end of the Cold War, over the last 30 years or so, is at the hands of elected leaders.
Is that happening again right here? Two scholars of the history of democracies offer a sobering, dispassionate answer. Also today, Governor Baker gives the 2018 State of the Commonwealth address tonight. We'll assess how well he fulfilled the vision he set out for Massachusetts in last year's address.
We worked to fix state government, passed groundbreaking legislation, and focused on growing our economy, and it's working.
Plus, a father gets a devastating diagnosis for his daughter. She's going progressively deaf and blind, but he's making a huge difference in his daughter's life through a game. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On June 16th, 2015, Donald Trump announced his candidacy for President of the United States.
Sadly, the American dream is dead. But if I get elected president, I will bring it back bigger and better and stronger than ever before, and we will make America great again.
On July 21st, 2016, Trump accepted the GOP's nomination.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
And on January 20th, 2017, Trump became the 45th president of the United States. Our guests today opened their new book with the question. Donald Trump says he alone can fix American democracy, but they ask, is he instead endangering it? Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt are professors of government at Harvard University, and for years they've been obsessively studying how authoritarianism rises and democracies fail around the world. And they apply that scholarship and analysis to the United States today. It's in their new book called How Democracies Die, and they join us in the studio. Professors Levitsky and Ziblatt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So is American democracy dying?
Well, you know, we take a stand in this book, and we really think this is right. The democracy is neither dead nor dying, but there are certainly warning signs. And we're anxious, and we're worried about American democracy and both the election of Donald Trump, but really one of the points of our book, it's not about just Donald Trump. The problems run deeper than Donald Trump. And so that's really what we try to get at in this book.
And the problems certainly predate Trump. And I think Trump himself is a symptom of or a result of those challenges. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted to play those two pieces of tape from when he announced in 2015 and from his nomination speech, because just even in those two moments, we hear, I think, strains of authoritarianism. But I guess what I want to ask you guys, you two, is in your book, you talk about how you've created a test, for example, of how to detect would-be autocrats before they get into office. So looking back at those two pieces of tape, for those two moments, for example, does Trump's candidacy pass your test?
Well, I think those clips show that he's a classic demagogue, and demagogues are often pretty dangerous for democracy. Now, what the indicators that we list in the book are certainly not a perfect litmus test. We call it a litmus test. It's not it's never foolproof. It's never possible to perfectly identify or always identify authoritarians before they come to office. But one of the things that we argue in the book is that it is much easier to stop an authoritarian before they come to power than afterwards. So
right.
It's really important for political leaders, for political parties, to take very seriously what we call their gatekeeping task, identifying and taking steps to keep autocrats or potential autocrats from power. And we think, not necessarily in those clips, mm-hmm. but a number of things that Trump said and did during the campaign were clear indicators that he's not committed to democratic norms.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you ask is, does the person or the party align themselves with extremists before they come to power, for example? Mm-hmm. Then instead the need is to, in your words, refuse to endorse or align with those extremists. But when fear, opportunism, miscalculation leads to established parties bringing extremists into the mainstream, democracy is imperiled. Now, I would say that on that front, we are in an imperiled democracy then.
Yeah, so if you look around the world, the way in which electoral authoritarians often come to power is not just by getting elected, but as you say, being aligned with establishment politicians. And so this happened in the interwar years and the dramatic breakdown of democracy in the 1920s and 1930s, where establishment politicians in Italy, for example, aligned themselves with Mussolini, hoping to tap into his electoral power and his popularity. And it was a grave miscalculation. It backfired. Mussolini suddenly was, you know, launched into his into leadership position, and these establishment politicians were kind of sidelined. Same thing happened in the 1930s in Germany with establishment conservatives and Adolf Hitler. Similar things happened in Venezuela in the 1990s, where Hugo Chavez came to power in part by being aligned with President Rafael Caldera, who had freedom from jail and in that way boosted Chavez's legitimacy. In each instance, the establishment politicians think that they're kind of they're forming a Faustian bargain where mm-hmm. they think this is going to help them out, and it ends up backfiring.
So in the case of Trump and the current day and GOP leadership, we should expand our analysis to political leaders in both parties, but it, specifically regarding the GOP, I mean, even though Trump denies it, he absolutely courted the far extreme right and in a certain sense continues to do so. They themselves say that he's using the language that the alt, quote-unquote alt-right has used. So, I mean, is that part of this pattern?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we do in the book is, as you mentioned, we have a litmus test. And so if a politician goes after the media, if they endorse violence, if they question the legitimacy of elections, if they threaten their rivals, you know, by you know to lock up their rivals or accuse their rivals of their political rivals of not being loyal to the country, these are clear hallmarks of an authoritarian. In addition to all of the offensive things he's said, you know, at a very basic, minimal level, if a politician does any of those four things that I just listed, we believe that the historical record suggests that establishment politicians must distance themselves from this kind of figure.
When Paul Ryan says, for example, when President Trump maligned a member of the federal judiciary because of his ancestry, and when Paul Ryan says, well, that's textbook racism, but I'm not going to do anything about it, what does that mean for our democracy?
It means that Republicans were abdicating their responsibility, their historic responsibility to defend democracy. Now, establishment Republicans were in a tough place. He won the primary. They didn't have any institutional tools to stop him from winning the primary. He was able to potentially deliver them and did eventually deliver them the presidency, Congress, and perhaps the Supreme Court. So he could do a lot for them. And the base was with Trump. So this was not an easy position for someone like Paul Ryan to be in. And what they tried to do was basically at times hide under the desk and very frequently talk out of two sides of the mouth. So I don't approve of this. I distance myself from this particular act. But they never took the essential step in terms of defending democracy of breaking entirely with Trump. When establishment politicians and they knew this in private. You talk to any of these guys in private, they knew Trump was a demagogue. They knew he was a danger. They knew he was potentially authoritarian. And yet they took this risk.
Hmm. Well, there's another sort of part of your analysis where you talk about how, the health of a democratic system can also be measured by how much autocratic leaders are constrained once they're elected, you know, by the other aspects of government. And I'm going to get to that in a minute because there's much to discuss there. But I want to zoom out for a second here, because one of the great strengths and uses of your book for all citizens who care about the health of American democracy is that you talk about trends, global trends, and specific examples around the world. And it's remarkable how you point out that before sort of Cold War and earlier, democracies fell in spectacular fashion, right? Military coup, for example. But that it's entirely different after the Cold War. What's that key difference?
The difference is it's far more likely today that democracy dies at the hands of elected leaders. In a majority, a pretty large majority of cases since the end of the Cold War, it's been elected presidents and prime ministers, often freely elected ones, who have disarmed democracy after being freely elected, who've used the tools and the institutions of democracy, paradoxically, to kill it or to wound it.
And you give the example, and maybe it's worth walking through it a little bit, of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Sure. Hugo Chavez was freely elected. Hugo Chavez governed in a fairly democratic manner in his initial years in office.
Survived a coup attempt, right? In fact,
the first anti-democratic move was clearly made by his opponents in 2002, and we argue that that was a serious consequential mistake on the part of the opposition. But eventually, the Chavez government slowly but surely began to go after the press, to punish independent media, to close down independent media, pack the courts, eventually begin to arrest opponents, exile opponents, and establish what is now a pretty authoritarian regime.
Mm. So what lessons, if any, can we draw from what happened in Venezuela to what's going on in the United States? Is it analogous at all?
Well, we have to be careful about the comparison because the United States is a much stronger democracy with much more robust democratic institutions than any of the other cases that we discuss in the book. Probably the closest comparison is actually Chile in the 1970s, mm-hmm. which is a very strong, very old democracy. Venezuelan democracy was relatively robust, but it was in a pretty severe crisis by the time that Chavez took office. So it's not perfectly analogous, but there are lessons, yes. And one of them, Daniel mentioned earlier, is that establishment politicians have to take every step possible to keep these guys out of office.
So tell me a little bit more about Chile, because are you referring to Allende or not? Because he was murdered, that was a coup, right?
Right. That was during the Cold War. Right. So that was an old style democratic death, which is death by the men with guns. So that was a classic military coup. The reason I say it's analogous to the United States is that there actually are not very many fully democratic regimes and established, stable democratic regimes in the world that have collapsed. Chile is one of the few.
Okay.
That's why we look to Chile for lessons. But we're not arguing that it died at the hands of Allende. We're arguing that in that case it died at the hands of the military.
Right, and with assistance from foreign governments as well.
Right. Indeed.
In the case of Chile.
One other important lesson I think that you can draw from the Chavez case is that democracies die slowly. And so, you know, it's hard for citizens and analysts when they're living through this to kind of recognize it.
So I want to ask you, because this idea, in your words, that democratic backsliding can begin at the ballot box is incredibly important for us to understand. Because in a sense, you know, there's that old saying that in a democracy, you get the leadership that you deserve. And I'm wondering if that's exactly what has happened here in the United States. We can have an argument about the Electoral College versus the popular vote. But I'm thinking that in a sense, Donald Trump, again, his rise is in part propelled by the fact that he was promising what many, many people in the electorate wanted. I mean, we were looking back at a January 2016 article from Matthew McWilliams, who was doing research through UMass Amherst. And he did polling across the country, and he wrote in January of 2016 that I have found a single statistically significant variable that predicts whether a voter supports Trump. It's not race, income, or education levels. It's desire for authoritarian leadership. I mean, he was detecting that back then. So I guess what I'm saying is those voters got what they wanted. They wanted authoritarianism or a form of it, maybe.
Well, that's what demagogues do, though, in some sense. What political leadership in part is about is not always responding to the impulses of publics. I mean, you know, this is a classical theme in democracy, and it's a paradox of democracy that democracy contains this vulnerability. And so, you know, the question is how do we keep such figures far from power? I think that's the issue, while addressing the underlying concerns that citizens genuinely may have.
Right. I want to take issue with the premise a little bit.
Sure.
I mean, there is pretty good evidence that Americans have long had an authoritarian streak. There has long and repeatedly throughout the last century been substantial public support, whether it's 30, 35%, nearly 40% of the electorate willing to support extremist demagogues, whether it's Father Coughlin, whether it's Henry Ford,
George
who flirted
Wallace,
with the presidency,
right.
George Wallace, McCarthy, Huey Long before he was assassinated. There, throughout history, we have a number of cases of extremist demagogues with authoritarian inclinations, just like Trump, in some cases more authoritarian than Trump, with a lot of support. People vote for a lot of reasons. People vote in many cases without a lot of information, with a bunch of different priorities and a bunch of different things in mind. The real responsibility lies not with the voters. The responsibility lies with political leaders and political parties. We argue that it's ultimately the role of party leaders to make sure that demagogues don't get the nomination.
Okay, so then let's look to our own history then for guidance here. In those other cases, none of them were presidents, though. I mean, in those other cases,
because they were kept out by parties.
I was going to say, yeah. So exactly what did the parties do to buttress the democracy in those cases?
Yeah. Well, so until 1968, or really till 1972, we had a different way of selecting our candidates. So until 1972, party leaders often picked candidates in smoke-filled rooms, which doesn't have a good reputation. And this was a very exclusive system where at conventions, party leaders would get together and choose the candidates that they thought would allow them to win. And they often worked up close with politicians and kept the guys that they feared out of office because they thought they wouldn't win. And so somebody like Henry Ford considered running for president, but it became very clear there was actually a survey done in the 1920s of party leaders, and he was very unpopular with Democratic Party leaders, whereas voters, he was very popular with voters. And so until the 1970s, we had a system in which party leaders picked candidates, and they, you know, and with, for all the problems, we're not arguing that we should go back to this.
I'm saying like the smoke-filled room doesn't, right. It sounds a step backward,
yes,
for democracy.
No, absolutely, right. So this in a way, but there's a lesson in that, which is that, you know, that there's a way in which our current system is, you know, it's clearly an improvement on the old system, but it's a double-edged system. I mean, it clears the way and makes the door, it opens the door for demagogues, the post-1972 election system.
But I feel like we are seeing, not just at the federal level, but at other levels in American governance, so many indications that our democracy is far more fragile than we thought. I mean, you guys write about this, the state of North Carolina, for example. You write about it extensively, but I'll just pick out one little fact that maybe folks know that it was just last year or a couple of years ago that the Electoral Integrity Project, also out of Harvard, basically said that North Carolina is so gerrymandered, voters are so disenfranchised, partisanship is so strong there that they can't even rate it as a democracy, a functioning democracy anymore. That's an American state. I mean, they put it right up there with Cuba. Or down there with Cuba, I should say. So, I mean, if that's also happening at the state level, again, are you looking to parties as being responsible for that?
Well, ultimately, what we think is responsible for the problems plaguing our democracy, I mean, there obviously are many things, but intense partisan polarization, probably the most intense polarization since Reconstruction, is leading our parties and our politicians, you're right, at the state level, sometimes at the local level, and now at the national level, to engage in the kind of fairly reckless behavior in terms of our institutions that can put democracy at risk, or at very least turn our democracy into a completely dysfunctional system.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at some writing from Andrew Reynolds, who's at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he basically concludes that governance is not arbitrary. It follows established rules, and is based on popular legitimacy. So he sees there's a negative feedback loop there when popular legitimacy is allowing for the further dismantling of democratic norms. I mean, to that end, I just want to ask you about the like if we could go as deep as we possibly could, even deeper than the level of hyper-partisanship about what's driving what seems like a slow erosion of American democracy. I mean, is it things like rampant inequality, racism, the weakening of public education, the adoption of policies by administrations that, you know, maybe Democratic and Republican, that aren't in the best interests of millions of Americans, and those things put together lead to this outcome of a weakening of democracy?
I don't think as political scientists we fully have the answer to this question yet. I mean, political scientists have been most of us have been somewhat late to the story here. I mean, it's with the election of Trump and with some of the institutional shenanigans that went on in recent years, for example, North Carolina, political scientists began to ask this question of why American democracy seems to be sliding into crisis. But we're just really beginning to ask these questions, with a few exceptions. I think one of the factors, which is we touch on in the book but don't develop much in the book, is on almost unprecedented inequality. We now have reached levels of income inequality higher than any time since before the Depression, and by some measures, close to highest levels of income inequality ever in this country. Mm-hmm. There's no question that that is corroding the quality of our democracy, that it is contributing to this immense gap between everyday voters and the elite, and is leading in fueling things like populism. Trump, at an important level, is a populist figure. Now, the primary focus, though, of the book is a little bit different. We think that race and culture ultimately are driving this polarization. Three things have happened since the 1960s to contribute to this. First of all, the civil rights movement and the success of the civil rights movement led to a massive migration of Southern whites from the Democratic to the Republican Party. Secondly, large-scale immigration transformed the demographics of this country, and the vast majority of immigrants ended up in the Democratic Party. And third, since Reagan, we have a massive migration of evangelicals, which used to be in both parties, equally split between both parties, are now overwhelmingly Republican. So whereas in the 1950s and the 1960s, even the early 70s, both parties were demographically very similar. They were basically both white Christian parties through the 1960s. Now we have two parties that are demographically very different. The Democrats are a party of basically urban educated whites or urban secular whites and a diversity of ethnic minorities. And the Republicans have become essentially a white Christian party.
So let me just jump in here. Are you saying that one of the reasons why our democracy, may be imperiled is racism?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. What's happening is that, so white Christians are not just any group, right? White Christians were a dominant electoral majority not long ago. And more than that, white Christians sat atop every economic, social, cultural, and political hierarchy that we had in this country, right? They were fixtures of local communities. They were the people who ran the businesses. They were the newscasters. They were the sports heroes. They were the politicians. They filled the presidency, Supreme Court, Senate, governor mansions. This is not that long ago, right?
They were the nexus of power, exactly.
So our society has transformed over 50 years. And many white Christians, not all Republican voters, but many Republican voters feel like the country that they grew up with is being taken away from them.
Understood. And this now, is we've heard this before, but what I guess what I'm saying is, what does it say about the inherent strengths or weaknesses of the American democratic experiment that if in this evolution, this transformation, we're talking about how American democracy might die?
Here's what we think it says. The democratic norms that sustained us in the 20th century in many, many positive ways, in which the two parties accepted each other as legitimate and basically played nice. That was founded on racial exclusion. That was those norms were created and sustained in an overwhelmingly white Christian society. They were created on the back of the racial exclusion of post-Reconstruction, It was essentially the Republicans' willingness, going back to the 1870s, the Republicans' willingness to abandon racial equality and to allow for the massive disenfranchisement of African Americans and the establishment of single-party authoritarian rule in the South and white supremacy in the South. That move in the 1870s is what allowed the two parties to come together and what allowed for the engendering and the sustaining of democratic norms in this country. What we haven't done yet is adapt to a diverse society based on racial equality.
So to get us back to the question of parties and their role in all of this, this leaves me feeling very depressed because it's the very same party leadership, specifically, I'm going to say, on the Republican side, that I don't see making any moves, having any drive or any meaningful desire to change this trajectory. You're shaking your head. Maybe am I being too pessimistic here?
So there's things for politicians and for parties to do on both sides. So, I mean, one of the things that we think is that the Democratic – well, first of all, the Republican Party needs to diversify. I mean, and the processes and phenomena that Steve is describing here
– I mean, it made attempts under George W. Bush. There was the big tent Republicanism.
Right. And they fell short, and there's lots of reasons, you know, maybe why that happened. But, I mean, at the end of the day, what we think needs to happen is that the Republican Party needs to refound itself and become a viable a party that can appeal to a broader swath of the American
electorate. Give me a little bit of hope, because you talk about how a sort of a party reckoning is possible, and you look to the former West Germany.
Yeah.
West Germany as an example. Yeah. Can you just briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the you know, key shapers of German political life through the 19th and 20th century was a dysfunctional right in Germany, and was only after World War II that the German center-right was refounded on a democratic basis. And so that's a model, but it's not a very exciting model at some level, because what was required was the devastation and tragedy of World War for the right to finally understand in Germany that it needed to be refounded on a democratic basis. The other part of that transformation in the German center-right after World War II, which, the U.S. played a major role in helping Germany democratize, but a major part of this was that it was this deep religious divide, similar to the kinds of religious divides that Steve is describing in the U.S. between Catholics and Protestants, had split the right for a century. And after 1945, for the first time, these two different segments of German society, Catholics and Protestants, who had despised each other and gone to a civil war with each other, joined together and created the Christian Democratic Party. Mm. Angela Merkel's party was a Protestant/Catholic party. And so, again,
we can ask how long that's lasting, though, right? Because
it's
her very party right now that seems to be in trouble with the rise of the extremist right in Germany. But I've gone way over time here. I have one last question very briefly, if I could, because this is so vitally important. I mean, you close your book by saying that you quote Daniel Ellen, also from Harvard, the remarkable Daniel Ellen, that basically the challenge, the great American challenge, is that we as a nation are trying to attempt something that has never been attempted before in humanity, right? In her words, it says, build a genuine multi-ethnic democracy where political, social, and economic equality are all achieved. Given everything that we've just talked about for the past half hour, do you still believe that that is indeed actually possible in the United States?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, this requires creative political leadership. It requires active citizenry. And these are the things, that we hope can happen. And one of the purposes of the book is, to look beyond just Donald Trump and to kind of put the full scale of the challenge in front of us.
Yeah. Look, if any democracy in the world is going to do it, it's ours. We have the oldest, most successful constitution in the world. We have very robust democratic institutions. We are a society that has successfully assimilated ethnic minorities in the past. We shouldn't forget how successful we were in the early part of the 20th century in assimilating other ethnic minorities. So, if there's a country in the world that's capable of doing it, it's ours.
Well, the new book is How Democracies Die. It's by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. Professors, thank you so very much for coming in. It's a remarkable book, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The majority of adults in this country with visual disabilities are also unemployed. The National Federation for the Blind says the jobless rate for people who can't see is close to 60%. It's statistics like those about people with vision impairment that sent a Middleborough man looking for ways to help his daughter adapt to a medical diagnosis. And WBUR's Peter O'Dowd has their story.
Do it. He'll do a cow. Here you go.
A little over a year ago, Rebecca LaCourse was diagnosed with a rare and cruel genetic disorder called Usher syndrome. She was born profoundly deaf. A pink headband keeps her cochlear implant in place. Her dad says at 2 years old, Rebecca's vision is already going too.
Worst case, she's completely blind in her mid-teens. Best case, she has her vision for her entire life. But what ends up happening, that peripheral vision really starts to close in. And it is. It's like looking through a pinhole. So that's what the prognosis is for her.
LaCourse has created a game to help Rebecca learn Braille. It's called BeckDot, and here's how it works. There are four large Braille cells and an electronic port on the game board, which is about the size of a laptop. When Rebecca puts a toy cow on top of the port, the gears turn. And the Braille dots that spell out the word cow pop up in the Braille cells.
So then we can move over to, like, this is a little pig, pop the pig on, and it'll pop up the word pig.
And you can hear the pig oinking or the cow mooing.
Correct.
And Rebecca actually likes it.
What we love to see when she plays with it is all she tries to do is take her finger and mash the dots back down. But that's her learning.
LaCourse is a product engineer by day, so he has experience making things. He wants to sell the toy for under $100. The idea is to help little kids learn early Braille concepts to get them ready for a long journey of adapting to a world that's built for people who can see. Ike Presley with the American Foundation for the Blind says it's not the first time a parent has built something for a blind child.
Yes, this was back in the 70s.
The Opticon was created by a Stanford engineer named John LaVille, whose daughter Candy couldn't see.
And it was a system that used a little miniature camera that you could roll over print. And then it was connected to a box that had an array of vibrating pins in it. And the pins would vibrate in the shape of the letter.
At the time, it was a high-tech innovation and widely used. Presley says Jake LaCourse's invention probably won't help kids develop the fine tactile skills they'll need to read much smaller Braille cells. But he says there is value to the work he's doing.
It gives him an opportunity to actually do something besides just sit around and wait for the doctors or, you know, whoever to come up with a miracle cure.
Back at home, little Rebecca is demanding slices of cheese and storming through the kitchen wearing her mother's snow boots. They go all the way up to her hips.
Mama.
She's trying your shoes on. Those are too big for you. Rebecca is a typical toddler, but when her mother, Beth, got the news that her daughter had Usher syndrome, it didn't seem like she would be. Just about 20,000 people in the U.S. are thought to have it. And what's typical about a child going deaf and blind?
I was just sick for days. I didn't want to leave the house.
As parents do, she had envisioned a life for Rebecca even before she was born.
I want her to be able to play sports and musical instruments. I want her to have friends. I want her to be good in school and math. All of my hopes and dreams that I had for her kind of came crashing down, you know.
And still, it's difficult.
Her night vision is going now. She says, when she's in a dark area, she says hi constantly just to get the feedback so that she knows you're there. So we're constantly saying hi back to her so that she knows we're right next to her.
Inventing the game, BeckDot, is one way that Jake LaCourse has dealt with what's happening to his daughter.
Beth calls this my way of coping. It definitely is. And you know, and I, the thing that really helps me is raising awareness so that eventually we could be a small part of.
Jake's eldest daughter, Reagan, can see that her dad is about to cry. The 8-year-old darts across the kitchen, throws her arms around his legs, and looks up at him with a goofy smile.
Toothless. Be a small part of finding the cure, right? So that's really what we want to do.
And that is exactly what he's doing.
That report from WBUR's Peter O'Dowd. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Governor Charlie Baker gives his third State of the Commonwealth address tonight. And this year, he's providing his vision for Massachusetts ahead of his own re-election bid and national midterm elections. Now, WBUR will be providing complete coverage of the governor's speech tonight beginning at 7 p.m., so hope you tune in for that. But right now, let's take a look at the goals Baker set for the Commonwealth in his 2017 address and whether he hit them. Joining us to help us do that is Ed Lyons. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist, political writer, and co-host of the Lincoln Review podcast. Ed, it's good to see you again.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Also with us is Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's good to see you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So first of all, just give me your quick takes. We'll talk about what we might hope to hear the governor say tonight. Ed, you're going, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're going to be there. Okay. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But give us your quick take in terms of how Baker did in 2017. Ed, you first.
I think it was a great year for the governor, and I think it was another great year for Massachusetts politics. I think we have productive bipartisan government. I think Charlie Baker is the linchpin of a system that we can be proud of, and especially as many of us are not proud of our national politics, I think it's great that we have such good state politics.
So a very rosy assessment there. Tiziana, do you share that?
I think it was a really competent year with a strong economy and a lot of focus on some things that are really hurting the Commonwealth, like the opioid crisis. If you want to know who I'm a fan and cheerleader of, it's the head of the Executive Office of Health and Human Services, Mary Lou Sutters. I think she was a strong appointment and has kept her eye on the ball on some key things like Department of Children and Families, addiction, et cetera. Yeah. And I think it's a hard year for individual people and a strong year for the economy.
So let's talk about what the governor said last year regarding the opioid crisis. Here's what he said at the 2017 State of the Commonwealth.
Now, we all know, especially here in this room, the opioid epidemic is ravaging individuals and families across this country. And while this is going to be a prolonged battle, our efforts are making a difference. We know that 4 out of 5 heroin users first become addicted through prescription drugs. And we're seeing results from our efforts to close this front door to addiction.
So that's Governor Charlie Baker last year. And in fact, when you look at the state's numbers, right, from November 2017, and you compare the first 9 months of 2016 to the first 9 months of 2017, overdose deaths dropped 10% here. But it's obviously still an ongoing problem. So actually, Tiziana, since you brought it, let me start with you. What more would you like to hear and see Charlie Baker do in 2018?
Well, I think we have to both continue to focus on recovery beds and treatment. It's hard to fund. It's hard to build capacity. But this is like the flu pandemic meets cancer meets crack, right? It's an insanely invasive and addictive substance that's going to continue to drive people to need real treatment. And we're going to have to continue to grow beds and services to help people break the addiction and find ways to try to stay clean.
Hmm. I mean, Ed, the governor was also on the presidential panel, the opioid panel as well. So he has had an opportunity to have his say and bring his expertise to the national level. Is there room for even more of that in 2018?
I have no sense of the fact that this current administration is really interested in what Charlie Baker has to say about that, despite the fact that they really should listen to him as, you know, somebody who's both the Republican and as somebody who cares about this and is working hard to improve the situation in Massachusetts. Of course, I imagine he would offer his opinion wherever it is offered. Other states are dealing with this. He has spoken to other governors that I am happy that he's being an evangelist because, you know, drug addiction doesn't know where state lines are, that it's in everyone's interest that the rest of the country begin solving this problem too.
Tiziana?
You know, in time of political gridlock, often we need to go to cities and states to find policy solutions and make progress. And the opioid crisis is one of those places where governors across the United States have a particular role to play. And if Governor Baker can be joining forces with a John Kasich, for example, out of Ohio, where they are ravaged by addiction, and create state-level solutions, that can really become a model for the country. And I think it's something that the states are going to have to treat as a priority because we're not going to get that at the national level.
So I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk about something else that the governor promised in his 2017 address. He talked about Bridgewater State Hospital specifically, and he proposed moving corrections officers out of the hospital and also funding Bridgewater more significantly and changing how treatment is done there. He did all of those things. He gets a win on that. I mean, that's one of the unmitigated successes of 2017, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic situation where there is an area that everybody wanted to get better. Everybody knew there was a problem, but solving it was complicated. He managed to get the corrections officers on board by promising there would be no reduction in staff. He managed to secure funding for it. Governor Patrick, in the last year of his administration, tried to propose reforms, but the legislature, for who knows what reason, didn't want to do them. And Baker came in and just solved it. He put experts in healthcare in there and turned it more into a treatment place than sort of a prison. And there's a huge win for Governor Baker and is the kind of social justice work that he doesn't get enough credit for.
Tiziana, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think actually the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is, all things considered, is doing very well on mental health and addiction. It's a huge relief to see things better at Bridgewater State. Again, I think that runs deeper than just the governor and down into his administration and a lot of very dedicated life career administrators who are solving administrative problems. And I find that one to be quite encouraging.
Yeah, so he knows how to hire good people in these sectors.
I think that's right.
And I absolutely give the governor a ton of credit for, you can tell when he really cares about certain issues and he has very specific proposals for them. He does what he can to follow up on them. And a lot of times it's really successful. I would say there's other policy areas where he has had that same passion and that same specificity, but hasn't been as successful. I'll turn to education on that front. Last year in his State of the Commonwealth address, he did once again say Massachusetts overall is doing pretty well in education. Here's what he said.
Thanks to the hard work of state and local officials, teachers and parents, our students are number one in the nation in both math and reading for the sixth straight year.
But in the same speech, he also talked about he wanted to open more so-called empowerment zones, right? There's one in Springfield, and it's where middle schools and high schools, they're working together with slightly more autonomy. And the governor said, to assist struggling schools, we will work with Representative Peisch and Senator Lesser and their colleagues in the House and Senate to create more empowerment zones. We can't find any evidence that any more were created, Ed. So that's something that
I think you should call the teachers unions. I think they were the reason why we didn't get any, because, and I think Senator Lesser was surprised to discover how unpopular his proposal was when he got a call from the unions.
So why is it that we get to that the unions get the blame for that and Governor Baker doesn't get any blame for or hold more responsibility for not pushing his agenda with greater
agreed effectiveness? I mean there are all kinds of areas where Governor Baker has wanted something that didn't happen. He wanted the state legislature to embrace cost reforms at MassHealth, and they said no. Does he deserve some blame for that? Sure. It's his job to persuade people to do things. So, you know, I just think there's a lot of issues like this, whether it's DCF, whether it's MassIT, whether it's MBTA. There's a union involved, and they have to be brought on board in order to get things done. And when that doesn't happen, then the reform doesn't happen. We see that all the time.
Tiziana?
So as someone who's a little more in favor, perhaps, of collective bargaining, I would say that usually when two groups come to the table and you don't get a deal, there's something going on with each group. I think the governor in this particular case probably hamstrung himself to some extent by his very strong outreach about charter schools, about the ballot question on charters, et cetera, which is sort of like, you know, lighting a little bit of a bomb right in the middle of what you're trying to do. Now, at the same time, I think disparity in school performance, which is the issue for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, do things like your race and socioeconomic status determine what kind of school you go to? That's also a local issue, and we have to work heavily with cities and towns. But there's a lot more that we could do to bring people to the table and keep them at the table negotiating on this. And sooner or later, we're going to have to do that. I mean, we're at 25 years of people on the two sides of the table saying, well, it's the other one's fault.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. Because Governor, Ed, I'm going to turn back to you. Because Governor Baker clearly has an expertise and excels in technocratic type fixes. But I think Tiziana is pointing something out that's quite important. Like it or not, there are lots of groups at the table for major issues in Massachusetts who, you know, are very dug in on their positions. What more should the governor do? Is he capable of fostering more negotiation between these groups?
He's just the governor. I mean, he's not the king. I mean, you know, as a Republican, I say, you know, he's just the executive. We have legislature. We have lots of wonderful nonprofit groups that are involved. There's individual citizens who can get involved. There's local involvement. I don't think that Troy Baker should be held accountable to sort of solve every problem. He can't and should not do everything. I don't think it's all up to him. That doesn't mean he shouldn't work to persuade people to accept compromises, but I don't think it's necessarily his job to make everything work.
I'm pausing there because I think that what you said is a realistic assessment of the limits of public office. But on the other hand, he's the chief executive for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Perhaps he could provide a greater vision that brings everybody on board in a more effective way. Is that something that perhaps the governor could do?
Well, we're going to have this discussion for an entire year about Governor Baker's lack of vision.
Yes, we are going to have this discussion.
I mean that literally. Are you going to have me in front of a microphone here 2 months from now saying, you know, he's taking, you know, hits on the vision thing. And I imagine Steady Worm will talk about nothing else for several months than the vision thing. So I don't mind bringing that up now if you want. But, you know.
Well, so it's an interesting conversation in the evolution of leadership. And you know, I get it's January 2018, but I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that Charlie Baker is going to have a second term. All right. So as we think about the evolution of a leader, when one demonstrates, has a vision of and demonstrates management competence, which I think you can argue the governor has done in his first term, you might want to see someone reach for the next stage of leadership in their second term. And investment in things like strong track to diplomacy, a unifying vision, more team members who are charismatic, use their social connections and relationships to bring new and creative groups to the table, would be a good chapter two. And it's not too early to be thinking about such a chapter two. I don't think all of that can happen in 2018. But some move in that direction, I think, is the evolution of leadership in general.
So I want to talk about this more in a slightly different way. Because, again, I went back and re-listened to and read the governor's speech, State of the Commonwealth speech last year. And in terms of identifiable goals, vision, whatever you want to call it. I mean, we talked about empowerment zones. He talked about forming a council on older adults. He wanted to increase state support for municipal health spending, invest more in the Commonwealth's infrastructure. Sadly, on that point, that's a decades-long problem.
He announced a new commission today, actually, on the future of transportation.
Yeah, we still get a D-plus, though, in the infrastructure report card. Bridgewater State, we talked about all these things. But I don't know. Ed, you're going to roll your eyes at this, but I still hunger for Charlie Baker, man of vision. And here's from last year's speech, as close as I think that he got.
Our Commonwealth is strong because we listen and we learn from one another, knowing that our goodwill can make our disagreements a catalyst for better ideas and real results. Now, our team looks forward to working with you in the challenges and opportunities of the next 2 years. We will advocate, we will engage, we will learn from you and others, and we will be better for it.
Now, I appreciated this part because, I mean, a call for civil governance, we need that more than ever in the United States now. But here's why I'm bringing all this up. This is my giant prelude to what I'm about to say. Charlie Baker is the most popular governor in the country right now. He's possibly the most popular Republican in the country. Very smart.
It's easier now.
Hugely capable. obviously, also an ambitious person. I mean, he seems to be perfectly set up to provide a moderate, centrist Republican vision. I'm going to keep using that word. That can bring tons of people on board, and yet I don't see him making that reach.
You mean the monorail to Springfield?
But why not? You're laughing, but I'm serious. I feel like the GOP, America needs Charlie Baker to be more, I don't know, rah-rah, to provide a great vision for what he thinks the future of the country should be. Why not?
You know, as somebody who had to bring three small children to a registry location in Revere about a month ago, where I didn't have to lose an entire day with a toddler in my arms squirming around because he reformed the RMVs, you know, good governance is better than you think it is. So, you know,
it's vitally important. I'll give you that.
I just think that he is open to ideas. Ask any transit nerd whether they feel more plugged into the MBTA now than they did 4 years ago. I know the Transit Matters people and all of them, they're all pleased the fact that they feel like they're being listened to because things they advocate are actually becoming policy at the MBTA. They're much more open to outside ideas and specialist groups than they were before. I think that's the same case in healthcare, too. I get the feeling that Secretary Sutter's is also open to input from the community. So I do think there is more collaboration than you'll read about in the Boston Globe. But it is true. Governor Baker has not had this defining moment like we're going to build the North-South rail line.
Yeah.
No huge project.
Or this is who we are as a commonwealth.
He's got tons of political capital. He could do this.
Well, it's really interesting. I also find myself thinking he's fortunate that he is running in 2018 and not 2020, because I'm not sure he could dodge the call to be a Republican voice at the national level in a 2020 election the way I think he's going to be able to in a 2018.
Well, Tiziana Dearing, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Republican activist and political writer and co-host of the Lincoln Review podcast, thank you so much as well. And I just want to remind folks that, again, the governor's giving his 2018 State of the Commonwealth address tonight. WBUR will provide live coverage of that beginning at 7 p.m., so tune in. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.